welcome to yet another edition of Britainology, the podcast that aims to dissect Britain. What is the deal with Britain? And indeed, what size is Britain? I'm Milo Edwards, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, Nate Bethay.
That's correct. I have just returned from a working holiday accompanying my wife while she's onboarding at a job in Geneva, Switzerland. She'll be back in the UK shortly, but she was there for 2 weeks. And so I took the train like a fancy lad.
True Euro vibes guy.
Yeah, I wanted to encapsulate Euro vibes. And it is very funny because, as you get closer and closer to Britain, you just start to feel the pull, the energy. Even the towns in northern France, like that you can see from the train, basically look like British towns. It's weird. It's just a gravitational
starts
pull.
Starts to transform.
Yeah, exactly. It's no longer the sort of like Loire Valley chateaus of your imagination. It's just basically the French equivalent of Toby Carvery, just right there by the motorway. And so I'm back. Beautiful day.
Toby Devion.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how horrified the French would be by Toby Carvery? I would love to watch a TV show of just making a bunch of French people eat a Toby Carvery.
I've never been to one, and I should go because it's like a Britainology field trip.
Yeah, we could do that, actually. So what's fascinating about like Toby Carvery as a thing is it's not like there's like a lot of British chain eateries, like your Harvesters or whatever, where they just kind of serve like Wetherspoons type food. Like you can have a burger and chips, you can have a steak, you can have a fucking roast dinner if you're feeling that brave. But there's also the Toby Carvery, specifically what a carvery is that distinguishes it, is that like it's like a kind of roast dinner buffet.
Ah.
So you go there and like they have like just like fucking slices of like different meats like in a tray under a hot lamp, and like, you know, gravy in a huge vat, and like, you know, vegetables in a tray under a hot lamp and stuff, and like it is gross.
So
like,
it's basically British Ponderosa Steakhouse. That's incredible.
It's like the Ponderosa Slophouse. Let's slop them up.
I'm gonna have to do this. We got to do a Britainology field trip. It would be like me taking you to medieval times in America, but it's a
Take me to a Sizzler.
Do they even have Sizzlers anymore?
I don't think so.
I remember going to Sizzler as a kid, but it's just that's just like the before times in so many ways.
You do a Midwestology field trip to, you know.
Oh, fuck. Take you to Denny's. Take you to, all the brand names are in my mind and I can't even remember anymore.
I've been to quite a few of the real American standards, like IHOP or whatever.
Have you been to Waffle House? Because your sister lives in Tennessee, I figured.
I've not been to a Waffle House, no, although I have driven past them. But we went to IHOP when I was in Tennessee. So
take you to a Perkins Diner, but it's not the same because back in the olden days, Perkins is still 24 hours, but Perkins was... had a smoking section, and they didn't invest themselves in trying
this
to figure out.
This is what they took from you.
Yeah, whether or not you were of legal age to smoke. So that was like one of my hangout spots in high school with me and my friends, because there was nothing to do if you were our age. Even if you were over 18, like anything that was interesting would be 21 and over anyway. So we would just hang out in Perkins and just like basically have coffee and no food and just smoke. Just like, you know, me and like...
You've always been Euro vibes deep down. Coffee, no food, and smoking.
But it's a very different vibe when coffee is just like a pitcher brought out by a very haggard night shift waitress. And it's you and like two 17-year-olds and a 16-year-old. And you're 18. Obviously, you're not like 40. You know, this isn't like non-sour. But it's like you and your other teenage friends just hanging out and bullshitting and smoking. Also, this is in the pre-smartphone era, so it just like wasn't that much.
You're at a kind of like Euro Disney version of Euro vibes, you know? Like you're experiencing
like,
a sort of
I feel like anyone who's been to a Perkins Diner knows how not Euro vibes this is. So like
if you had Euro vibes described to you by a child who'd been there once and then attempted to reconstruct it in Indiana.
You're trying to shoehorn Euro vibes into this, and it's basically like I'm watching you like you're watching a child swing at a pinata fully in the wrong direction, and I'm just like,
No, I mean, I understand what you're saying about Perkins Diner being extremely grim and not Euro vibes in that sense. But it's just funny that it contains these headline Euro vibes items like coffee, cigarettes, not eating anything. It's like a kind of cursed, like the punished Euro vibe.
But every window has curtains next to it. Like it has this weird sort of semi-homespun feeling. I remember there being like in the front, there was like a bakery counter at the front. You like glass cases, you could get like pastries to go and stuff. But yeah.
Oh yeah, fuck. This is like being, it's like Czech vibes. It's like Polish vibes. I mean, like kind of like where you say, the further east you go, like the more cursed the Euro vibes become.
Yeah.
I've fully been to a fucking place like that in Croatia, in Zagreb, where we walked in there with, there was one Croatian guy with us. And then we were like, dude, this place is like fully not changed since 1985 that I'm surprised there isn't a picture of Tito on the fucking wall. Like, it was just like, everyone's drinking coffee. The food is just slabs of meat. Yeah.
I mean, someday, Milo, I hope I get a chance to see Balkans Euro vibes because maybe you or someone else, you know, in our greater podcasting universe can be the guide, the sort of Virgil of the Balkans Inferno to explain, because I've always wanted to go and I've never been able to.
Yeah, documentary series, me, you, and Dan Beckner on a tour of the worst parts of the Balkans.
Yeah, you have to get there by boat from Italy, and it has to be a 28-hour boat ride, and that's, you have to be right. Sick the entire time.
Yeah, we're doing North Macedonia, we're doing Albania, we're doing Belgrade. Man, Belgrade fucking sucks. I went to Belgrade once on stand-up tour. We did a stand-up tour of like the whole of the former Yugoslavia, basically, and we started off in Slovenia. Slovenia is fucking nice.
I've heard it's really nice, yeah.
Slovenia is like Italy, but they talk funnier, right? It's fine. Then you get into Croatia and you're like, okay, this is like slightly fucked, but it's still basically fine. It has the fundamental character of like a European country, like the roads function, you know, the food's a bit shite, but whatever. Then we cross the border into Serbia, and it's like literally as soon as you cross the line, immediately the road is like, sorry, has this been shelled recently? Like, what is this? And I remember in Belgrade, we were staying in this hostel, and it was Orthodox Easter Sunday, which it turns out in Serbia they take very seriously, and like basically nothing was open apart from like a couple of like late night cafes and stuff, and the venue where we were doing stand up. And next to our hostel was this like unfinished building that was just like reinforced concrete poles like sticking out of the concrete slab in the ground, like all rusted. There's a big rusted sign with a picture of what the building is supposed to look like, and then it's like due to be completed June 2008.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of pictures that I've seen while playing GeoGuessr, and it's like I could always tell when I was in Albania, because I'm like, this basically looks like fucked Italian vibes. It's the best way to describe it. Like, it basically, it looks like your stereotypical impression of Italy, but like everything is spelled weird as hell.
Oh yeah. And too many Q's.
And there's too many Q's, and there's lots and lots of buildings where it's like you described, unfinished concrete building with the rebar sticking out. Like, such a vibe. Like, it might as well be people's TV antennas.
But not even for tax reasons, like it is in Greece.
But what I would say though is, we're gonna talk about absolutely fucked vibes. We've got to segue it
this
into
MF segueing
our discussion of a TV show long lauded and feted called fucking...
It's definitely feted, I'll say that.
Little
about
Britain.
It.
You made me watch Little Britain. I was only aware of Little Britain because of the characters who have been referenced and the fact that Matt Lucas did blackface, because it feels
and David Williams did blackface too. I mean, they both did it.
The extent to which I linked Little Britain with one of Cynthia's friends, mutual friend, I suppose, we've gotten to be friends too, is a black British guy who grew up in Luton, and he grew up on an estate in Luton, and he one time told me when we were talking about some of this stuff about the whole, like, why have so many famous British Jewish comedians done blackface? And because, I mean, there's a long list, but obviously David Baddiel and Matt Lucas are two that are highly up on the list. And he said, man, I used to fucking dread going to school the day after Little Britain aired, because I knew there was going to be some racist shit and all the kids in my class were going to fucking be quoting it at me and doing like whatever Matt Lucas in blackface's character had said, like they were going to be doing it at me. This was in like primary school. And he's like, and then in retrospect, I'm still quoting him. He basically said, like, it's wild when I realized like that was in the 2000s that this was still happening.
It started in like what, like 2003?
And I mean, the fact that there was a Vietnamese character or Thai woman named Ting Tong, who was insanely racist character played by a white person in yellow face, or the various other characters,
I think,
like,
that was a David Williams character,
or the fake the person who's disabled who's actually faking it, or all of the homophobia, like the sort of like, wow, isn't it funny being gay, being gay is a laugh in a kind of like punching down way. Like, I watched one episode. I had no idea what I was getting into. I wasn't sure if it was going to be a sitcom. I didn't realize it was a sketch comedy show. I watched the entire 28-minute episode you sent me. I did not laugh once. I just grimaced and gritted my teeth. And I'm not even saying that from the perspective of like trying to be like a scold about it. It just wasn't funny. Nothing about it was funny. It just was fucking mean-spirited the whole time. But, like, the combination of mean-spirited and unfunny, it's like, if I wanted that, I'd read literally any political cartoon in this fucking country.
Yeah, I actually, to be honest with you, I found the mean-spirited parts the least jarring, because I think there were, like, there's quite a lot of quite mean-spirited stuff in there. But then there's also quite a lot of stuff that's, like, just fucking bizarre. And, like, to the, I think what shocked me going back to it, because I knew it was offensive, because I remember it, even as a teenager, it being like a thing that, like, if it was on, my mum would be like, oh, for fuck's sake. I think partly because there was those, like, gross stuff in it.
Yeah.
There was not really much of that in this episode, but, like, there was the whole thing. There was, like, a sketch about, like, an adult man being, like, breastfed by his mum or his wife, and he'd call it, like, bitty, like that. Someone was replying you on Twitter and talking about that, and I had a flashback.
Yeah.
There was another sketch where it was, like, two old ladies, and they'd always be, like, throwing up on each other. Like, yeah, there was a lot of, like, gross out stuff, particularly in the later seasons. But the way in which, you've got your kind of, like, your classic offensive stuff in there. They're, like, they're mocking the disabled, they're mocking the poor, like, whatever. But then it's so directionless. Like, it doesn't have that same, it's not even, like, it would be more coherent if that was what they were doing. But that's, like, 50% of what they're doing. And the other 50% of the time, it's this kind of, like, bizarre, just like unfunny sketches that are kind of like about nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you've got the fucking, like, the tour guide on the bus who keeps talking about, like, where he fingered his wife or whatever for the first time. The guy pitching board games to the guy who runs a tire business, and he, like, doesn't finish pitching any of them and moves on to that. And it just, but they're just like, none of it's like all the, of these the, are sketches
the,
that like
the teacher who married one of his former students, who's just like basically like being a teacher to her the entire time. Like,
that was the most painful one, I thought, actually, in terms of just pure, like, it was so hammed, like,
unfunny.
It was, all the jokes were like so obvious.
Yeah, and there was the toy shop. There was the one about the prime minister's aide being like sexy with him, and like, you know, completely unreciprocated, yeah, sort of gay panic kind of thing. There's the really kind of just what you might call almost overcooked narration. Like, everything about it is just, the best way I could describe it is it fucking sucks. Like, it's not even that I'm saying, like, it's bad because I morally am opposed to it. Like, this show, Britannology, but especially Trash Future, we are no strangers to jokes getting very close to the line. And we enjoy that. Like, that's how we find humor in this miserable time that we exist in. But I think if a joke's going to be in anywhere close to a realm of potentially, like, lampooning what you might call someone in not even a minority position, but just rather like someone who's in any way deviated from like a normative standard. That's a very polite way of phrasing it, but like,
yeah.
In any way, you can do it, but it's got to be funny. Mm. It's got to actually be funny. And like,
that's really the issue at the core of this show.
Is that not, like, basically none of the jokes are funny. So the jokes that are at the expense of gay people, disabled people, poor people, all of them just feel like the point of the joke is like, oh, that person's fat, that guy is gay, and like, it's just not funny. I mean, years ago, before my grandfather died, I was going through some of the books, because my grandfather, being my fucking grandfather, like, he basically didn't read any fiction books at all. Besides, he had like a couple of books by William Faulkner, and
he's just reading books called like Stalingrad.
100%. Enemy at the Gates is one of them. Yeah, 100%. Yes.
Your grandfather was Mark Corrigan.
My grandfather was an army officer, and like, he only read nonfiction books. But I was flipping through some book that interested me. Maybe it was some book about Stalingrad, I can't remember. And I found one of my uncle had been a political cartoonist at his school newspaper at like the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, or some shit like that in the 70s. And there was this cartoon, and I'm going to just describe it panel by panel from memory, which is a little bit difficult. Basically, it was like a girl and a guy coming back from the bar, and the girl's like, let's go to your place. And then the guy was, the next panel is them like walking into the room, and the guy's like, no, wait, don't turn on the light. And then the next panel is bang, like a gun going off. And the last panel is the woman with a gun. And there's a dude in bed biting a pillow, which is like, I knew you were hiding something. And that's it.
What?
That's it. And I was just like, what the fuck is this? This doesn't make any sense at all. But my uncle's inscrutable homophobic cartoon. And the whole point of the joke was just like, a guy is gay. And that's it. And that's what this reminds me of. Like, it makes no fucking sense. Other than just like, this guy is fucking gay. He likes to kiss dudes and go to bed with them.
Your uncle accidentally predicted podcasting. Absolutely incredible.
This is insane. Don't remember, my uncle's fucking insane. Like,
you have to respect that. It's just so surreal. And this was like printed in the newspaper.
Printed in like the '70s, yeah.
Oh, the '70s, they were a magical time.
Yeah. I guess your college newspaper, you just do whatever the fuck you wanted. But like,
I love the idea that like the guy, he's got like a naked guy in his bed who's like there, just like in the ready position to be fucked.
Just biting a pillow, yeah. Yeah, like, yeah, that's how it's communicated.
Go. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
incredible. Yeah, I mean, and yeah, I think that's kind of what's so surreal about this is it's sort of neither Matt Lucas nor David Walliams are like really comedians. Like they were trained as actors.
Yeah.
They're in the National Youth Theatre together. And that's kind of what comes through in this like I would say that, I mean, not saying that like actors are all this offensive or anything, but like there's definitely a vibe when actors decide they're gonna do comedy,
mm-hmm.
and you just get these like weird, like usually inoffensive, but just like maladroit attempts at, because I think there's definitely like a thing where like acting school imbues actors with the idea that like you're trained in a high art, you're actors. And then they're like, comedy, how hard could it be?
Use my method and just put on blackface. Everyone laughs at that.
It's called method acting. And then like you just see like some struggling actor deciding to like have a go at an open mic and they're just doing acting. But just like this show kind of has that energy about it where there's not really jokes in it. And there are like the weird thing is that there are occasionally sketches in it where they have the germ of like that could be a funny idea, but they don't really explore it in I think a great example of that is the only gay in the village sketch. So mm-hmm. in this episode, it was like the only gay Daffod. He's like he's planning this like gay night at the pub, and then he's dismayed when like other gays actually turn up. Now, particularly the way the other gays are portrayed is extremely homophobic.
Yes,
like they don't talk; they just make what I can only describe as homosexual noises.
Yes, just
and they're all like waggling their hands around and
hooting
like
homosexually, basically. Yes.
Yeah. But that recurring sketch about, that's definitely one of the ones, I think, if you talk to people of like my generation, that people remember from this show, The Only Gay in the Village. And it has the germ of a funny idea where it's this gay guy in this village in rural Wales. And he's constantly going on about how he's the only gay in the village as though it's like, oh, if only there were some other gays in the village. But actually, he loves being the only gay in the village and he like loves the attention that affords. And like, that's an interesting character of being like pretending that you're furious that there are no other gay, but actually it's completely the opposite. And soon as another gay guy turns up, you're like, fuck off. This is my village.
I gotta ask though, because okay, when I think back to like the early 2000s in America.
Yeah.
Let's not pretend that America was doing much better. Like, in those days, the sort of right-wing target was cis gay people.
Mm.
You know, we've talked about this before, that, like, representations of trans people were so poor up until, I mean, they're still terrible, but, like, they were basically treated as, well, not even really differentiated in any way. To the point where
it's that phenomenon where you need like a certain degree of progressivism before certain minorities even really get recognized as like a thing to be mad about.
I mean,
like,
a friend of mine said this on Twitter or on Facebook rather, that like growing up, like they're trans, and they basically said like, I didn't know that being trans was even a thing. I didn't know the concept existed that you could transition, you could change gender. I literally, when I saw trans people portrayed on TV, I just thought they were so gay that they put on women's clothes. Like, it was an extra layer of being gay. And it's like, so Jon Stewart, for example, was famous for making very transphobic jokes back in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, you had a show like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which was, you know, kind of breakthrough in the way that it just made gay people seem normal. Mm-hmm. But it still was like an object of derision. It's still like, there was a lot of people, I remember getting really kind of head up about the fact that like gay people were on TV, or that they were telling, they were like, oh, you know,
teaching gay people in the entertainment industry. Can you imagine?
Can you imagine like getting people like showing straight men how to dress better and stuff like that? Like the whole like sort of turning metrosexual stuff into like that the whole phenomenon of being like, oh, you know, all we're going to feminize men or some shit like that. So it was bad back then too. But I kind of want to ask if you could like put this in context. So like this was the early 2000s in Britain, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the early 2000s in Britain, what a magical time. New Labour are very concerned about teenagers loitering. You know, we're introducing the thing that makes a very high-pitched noise outside corner shops to prevent this.
For American listeners who may not be aware of this, this is 100% true and they're still around. There are these devices called mosquitoes. I think they have spread to places in America too, but this was definitely a British invention.
It's such a powerfully British-brained idea.
They came up with an idea for a buzzing loudspeaker that emitted a frequency that would be so high-pitched that adults would notionally have had enough sort of normal hearing loss in those frequencies, they wouldn't be able to hear them, but young people would.
Under 25 basically are the only people who can hear certain very high-pitched
frequencies. So the idea was that they would create a noise that was incredibly annoying to anyone 25 or under, and they put these speakers on like corner shops or in public areas as to hopefully ward off teens. They had anti-teen speakers. They also had these lights that were like...
Whereas they could have just put on like Michael Bublé or like Harry Barlow or something.
They also had these lights that were meant... They were like a pink light that were meant to highlight and exaggerate acne with the hopes that it would make teens so self-conscious they wouldn't want to hang out.
We're giving the teens body dysmorphia. Then they'll fuck off.
When I describe this stuff, you have to realize...
We're actually hiring some bitchy gay guys to hang outside the corner shop and criticize their fits.
They're just going
to
sass them all day long until they fucking go inside and be nerds. Yeah. What's funny about this or sad about this too is people that I know are like, like they didn't work as well as people thought, or like teen kids who worked in shops had to hear them all day long just having their ears blown out. Mm. I know people who were like, they put them up like on a shop in my neighborhood and I could hear them in my house all the time I was home. Friends told stories about how they would record the sounds in the smartphone era, rather, and would then play them back in class because the teachers couldn't hear them, but all the other kids could, just to fucking annoy the shit out of their classmates. Like, amazing. Pandora's box for annoying the young. But yeah, this is definitely a British thing. But yeah, like, the sort of antisocial behavioral ordinance, is it, or order?
Antisocial behavior order, yeah.
Basically,
antisocial behavior ordinance is a very funny idea. Well, we're shelling the young.
Ordinance, if I remember correctly, in America, is used in the same way as order, but ordnance, like military munitions, is a very different thing, but yeah, they, so like, there was.
I fired 100mm whippet.
Years ago. There's a guy who writes The Independent, friend of the show, John Stone, did a very long thread about all the insanely authoritarian and just like weird, cruel right-wing shit that New Labour did. And so much of it was sort of fixated on this idea that like the British worker and the British citizen are lazy and shiftless and have to be disciplined.
Tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. I mean, this is, I think people remember education. But I mean, one of Tony Blair's big things was like crime. And like bringing crime, I think he thought that like that was a good way of selling himself as like, well, I mean, heaven forbid we should compare this to the current iteration of Labour, but like being obsessed with the idea of like covering for the fact that you're a Labour politician by being seen to be like serious and right wing about certain things is like a classic vein in sort of like the last 40 years of British politics. Yeah,
which is interesting to me because that then filters down into culture. And that's the thing that people who have talked to us about this show have mentioned, that there's a way in which this feels like a very New Labour show because of the way that it just so kind of wantonly punches down at people. Mm. And I think the combination of it being not funny, but also very, very cruel, kind of reinforces the idea that those people's existence in any form is the joke. That's the joke. That's the thing you're supposed to be laughing. A bald guy is in a wheelchair is supposed to be the joke. You know, someone is fat. That's supposed to be the joke. Like the one with the weight loss fucking thing where the lady is like, you know, but right before the weight loss meeting starts, she has to very like apologetically tell one of the other guys, the people in the class that she fucked when they went to the pub together. Like that's a one-time thing. It won't ever happen again. And then like, she just starts going on this tirade about like, imagine yourself naked and how disgusting it is to be fat. Imagine how fucking gross it would be to have some fat person heaving it into you and shit like that. And it's, that's the joke. The joke is, imagine if someone fat fucked you. How gross would that be?
I mean, I kind of think that the Fat Fighters sketch, which is like a parody of Weight Watchers, mm-hmm. I mean, such a thing in Britain in that era, or like Slimming World or whatever. Mm. I think that the joke, the butt of the joke is supposed to be the woman who runs the class and how much she hates the fat people in the, because she's also fat herself. I mean, she's played by Matt Lucas is pretty fucking fat, and he plays I think the famous, again, someone I think brought this up on Twitter, but the one time where she's going through like what you can eat on the diet, and then she's like, she's going through like how many calories are in each thing and getting them to guess. And she's doing like carrots or whatever. And she gets down, she's like, dust. Anybody? Dust. There's no calories in dust. You can have as much dust as you like. And I'm like, there's like one of those, there's like a rare moment in Little Britain where there's like actually a good joke. And it's like, you do know how to write a joke. Like there's that. And it makes it more frustrating because you're like, there's actually a joke in there. And they've, and like also, yeah, I mean, going back to the Only Gay in the Village sketch that we were talking about, like Matt Lucas is gay, right? So you would think that he would bring like a kind of interesting perspective to that, but it just isn't there. Even though it's an interesting idea, there's no, like, all that you get out of it mostly is homophobia.
Yeah. And it's, and I mean,
like, he's always wearing, like, a bondage outfit.
Right. And yeah. I mean, I watched the Ting Tong sketch, or a couple of them. And there
didn't, those are bad.
There didn't seem to be any real joke there besides Asian woman is a mail order bride played by a white guy in yellow face, and her name is Ting Tong. And that's it. Like, that's the joke. And, like, I'm not going to pretend America was fucking great about this shit. It's pretty bad. But you would have to have... That would have been the kind of shit that, like, Andrew Dice Clay would have had in his stand-up. It wouldn't have been on TV. And also, I'd say, like, for example, in this same era in America, the level of kind of, like, dumb punch-down or, like, gross-out shit would have been in movies way more than TV. But like Van Wilder has some funny jokes, the big college movie of my generation. But one big punchline in Van Wilder is a bunch of guys getting tricked into eating jelly donuts full of dog cum. And like
dog cum.
That's yes.
It's like a fucking drill tweet.
Lying, listeners? Is there not a fucking punchline in Van Wilder that these guys all eat dog cum? Like that is the joke. That is the joke.
Fuck off you bitches, I yell as I eat another donut filled with dog cum. It's this perfect drill.
So like that was or what is it,
I'll keep drinking that garbage.
Was the Bridesmaids, if I remember the name of the movie, like the scene where they all get food poisoning, everyone's just shitting everywhere, and like someone has to shit in the fucking bathroom sink and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean like the Nutty Professor and stuff is like that.
The Nutty Professor isn't that gross though, is the thing. Right. That's way more of a, also the Nutty Professor has a special place in my heart because it does in fact have the Nutty Professor takes Janet Jackson, if I remember correctly, to a comedy club, and Dave Chappelle's comedy line is "Women be shopping." Like, it's
they do,
and then the Nutty Professor looks over, much in the way like Dave Weigel trying to make a joke at the Washington Post, like, "Oh, women do be shopping a lot." Like, that's basically it.
Yeah.
But like that stuff was relegated to movies, which is to say that it was in the culture 100%. But it wasn't quite as accessible as something that was, you know, being broadcast on terrestrial TV. And that's the thing that I think that makes a difference is that a lot of this stuff, America wasn't yet at the point where you could even have, for woke reasons, for right-wing reasons, you couldn't have had a character like the Only Gay in the Village on an American TV show back then.
Yeah, so yeah, Britain has always had, or at least in sort of like, if you like, in the modern memory, like over the last 40, 45 years, quite a liberal approach to TV. Like you would see a lot of stuff on TV. I mean, there was serious gay representation on TV. I think in like the early 90s, like you had Queer as Folk.
Queer as Folk was on.
Was that even maybe the 80s?
I think it was in the 90s, and it was remade in America, but it was on premium cable because you absolutely could not have a show like that. Yeah. And if I remember correctly, Queer as Folk, the British version, is quite a bit more openly sexual than the American version in the sense that like you just couldn't
unsurprising
you couldn't get away with it.
Well, Russell T Davies, friend of the show, writer of Years and Years.
If only he could remake it now and get the guy with the concave ass to be on there.
Rory Kinnear, what a world we could have lived in. But I think this is probably where we get into like this is an interesting moment in British history, because I think Little Britain it, like, we've sort of covered the fact that it is, there's no getting around it. It is very offensive. There's a lot of very offensive stuff in there.
And it's also like a very like Blairite era document, call it that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think also what is so indicative of that area in sort of that era in Britain, if you like, is how it's very oblivious, I think. And I think this is the one thing where I do like at least partially believe like Matt Lucas, especially when he talks about it, which he doesn't often. Because Matt Lucas actually has come out and apologized for a lot of the stuff, which is more than you can say for David Baddiel.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it, like, and I think one of the things he said is that like they kind of didn't really understand like the extent to which is baffling, right? When you think about it. But I think this does resonate having grown up in Britain in that era. Like Britain is, and I think even if you've grown up in America, which is like, it's a really fucking racist country. But by and large, if you're being racist in America, you're kind of doing it with some sort of understanding of like, and I think an amazing quantity of people in Britain, and certainly like me at that age, definitely growing up in like the home counties is extremely white. Like,
yeah.
And I think that kind of like, I don't know, like a lack of awareness about race, especially, is something that you'll notice a lot in like British stuff, and especially British stuff of this era, where it's kind of come out of like the 70s and 80s, where you'd get more stuff that's like, it's very deliberately being racist because it's like, racism is good, into this era of like, oh, is that racist? And it's like, looking back on it, you're like, obviously.
Yeah, but, Jesus.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's like, it's important to wrap your head around. Like, I think Britain is like, it's a country of like deep obliviousness, particularly about race, but about a lot of other stuff as well.
Something that's interesting to me is that I grew up primarily in a white flight suburb of Indianapolis. I moved there when I was 11 and then I stayed there until I went to university, and I went to university in the state of Indiana. So I spent most of my life, I've got about, 7 more years to live abroad before I'll have, or really anywhere before I'll have lived in one place longer than where I lived in Indiana. So I can feel like I can speak to Indiana pretty decently. And I would say that there was definitely an obliviousness, or rather a kind of uncaring, affected obliviousness towards being sensitive to race. But I don't think there was ever a moment when people weren't cognizant of it.
Yeah.
Like, I remember this very clearly. My 11th grade physics teacher was the only black teacher I had ever at my high school. My high school had 3,600 students, and I think we had maybe 60 or 70 kids who were black. And most of them were either, their parents were like professionals, like they were like doctors or professors at Butler University, or they were from a part of the north side of Indianapolis that had been annexed into Carmel. But like, right, Carmel was fully a white flight suburb. So like, the reason why there weren't very many black kids was because black people weren't allowed to move to Carmel like well into the 70s. No one would sell them houses. Like Marion County, where Indianapolis is, did busing for a while, and like a flood of white parents left Marion County if they could afford to, so that their kids wouldn't have to go to school with black kids. So like, that's all very deliberate. But anyway, my 11th grade physics teacher was black. And he had been a aviation engineer, and then he'd been in the Peace Corps and decided to become a teacher. And I remember very clearly when they were doing an announcement, because we had, it was pretty normal for kids to drive to school there, because there was, you know, there was no public transportation and school buses sucked and it was a really long ride. So like, if you lived close, it was much easier to just drive. And we had one main lot, and then we had a lot basically in the, around the back of the football stadium. Because of course, being a big American high school in the Midwest, we had a football stadium.
Yeah.
And kids called that the ghetto lot because it was the furthest lot away. Now, it became so normalized to call it that, that people would make announcements over the intercom for like, oh yeah, this happened, we're having a meeting in the ghetto lot. And I remember Mr. Thomas just being like, ghetto lot? Like, what? You could see, like, he wanted to say, what the fuck are you saying? Obviously he couldn't say that in a room full of white kids. But like, I could just see that, like, and it's like, that was the first time it dawned on me, like, oh yeah, we're using ghetto to mean shitty because we say that about where we make black people live in this country. Like, it dawned on me in that moment, like, there's so much about what we do here that's very obviously being racist. Like, it just like it's so baked into shit. But like, it would be very, very difficult for a show like Little Britain, even in the tame version, to get through on American TV, because I think both there would be more awareness and the fact that it would generate outrage. And I think that the impression I get is that even in the early 2000s on American TV, doing something like this would probably have hurt them more than it helped in terms of them losing advertising, because would get mad, because obviously we have ad-funded TV and stuff like that. And so...
Yeah, well, this show in America would be, like, perfectly calibrated to piss everyone off, because it would be, like, the fact of, like, doing, like, yeah, like, the gay representation, even in a homophobic way, would be offensive enough for the right, and then all the other stuff would obviously be offensive for the obvious reasons.
And when I think back on that era, like, I wasn't the most avid TV watcher, but, like, even Will and Grace having, like, gay people kiss was a thing that didn't happen until, like, the mid-2000s. Like, the idea of gay representation being shown in any way, like, it's pretty recent in America. And so I guess I just look at this and I'm sort of like, how the fuck did this get made? And like, what's the story behind it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is just kind of the story of like obliviousness. I mean, I think that like the whole thing with Matt Lucas and David Walliams is fascinating because they were just everywhere for a while. I think there was like an era in British comedy, which you can see has like definitely ended now, where... they were just kind of throwing shit at the wall. Like, they were just giving loads of people series. And, like, weirdly, it's indicative of, like, a better time in comedy commissioning. Although, obviously, some of the stuff it produced. But, like, the way in which, like, you know, guys could, like, come out of, like, university comedy, basically, and, like, get into stuff at the BBC and be allowed to, like, make stuff. And that just doesn't exist anymore, really. Like, there's not the budget for any of that stuff. Or, like... they kind of make, like, everything's made by the algorithm now, right? So, like, there has to be, like, 9 different shows that are all, like, satellite to the Great British Bake Off, and there has to be 9 different satellite shows to Love Island and whatever, because it's, like, whatever, like, can juice the viewership the most. TV is a dying medium, whatever. And then it's all kind of sewn up by, like, agents and production companies and, like, what they can sell and whatever. Whereas, like, this was kind of, I think there was this era where, like, particularly at the BBC, they were doing, like, quite, like, headstrong commissioning and stuff. So, I mean... I suspect probably the story of how this got made is surprisingly, like, random. Like, I suspect a producer at the BBC decided, because I think it started on Radio 4, and probably decided, oh, like Matt Lucas and Dave Williams, I like them, I'll give them a series, because it was around the time they started BBC Three, which was supposed to be the kind of, like, the wacky BBC channel where they did new stuff, in comedy particularly. And so, yeah, they were kind of right place at the right time to make a really bad TV show.
And this show was actually pretty popular, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it was definitely a thing that people watched. I mean, like, I'm definitely not going to sit here and pretend that I had excellent taste as a teenager, because I definitely did not. But this was one of the things where, like, I definitely did watch it.
Sure.
But it wasn't something that I, like, particularly liked. Like, there were definitely, and I mean, I think this came out in the discussion we were having on Twitter a bit earlier. Like, there are flashes in it of, like, stuff that's funny or good. Like, I mean, the, again, this wasn't in this episode, but, like, there was a recurring sketch where it's, like, someone trying to get something done at, like, a bank or whatever, and then, like, the customer service person is just going, like, nah, the computer says no. And I feel like that is... And again, it's weird. It's, like, this, like, incredibly, like, clear-eyed analysis, particularly at the time when I think our lives were less dominated by stuff like that, and then now it feels, like, kind of, like, weirdly prescient. Like, whenever you're trying to solve any problem in Britain, it's just people constantly going, like, the computer says no. I'm afraid I may be a person, but unfortunately the computer has said no and there's nothing we can do.
Cynthia and I, when we first got to this country, we had to open up a bank account, and we were able to open, she was able to open a bank account at Lloyd's with me if I opened one, because I'm a British citizen. But obviously many people who have emigrated to this country can tell you, especially if you're not a Commonwealth citizen, that you enter this death spiral when you first move to this country of you need a bank account to get an address and you need an address to get a bank account. And yeah, like incredible. No one can square this circle. And so we were in this hot fucking office on like a Friday at 4 p.m. at a Lloyd's office in like in Vauxhall, I think. Mm-hmm. And the guy has to put all the stuff through, all of our information to submit to get an account, except the app keeps crashing and he can only do this through an app on his tablet. Amazing. He can't do it on a fucking computer. He has to do it on this app. Like, that's the only way it's allowed to be done. So on, like, the fifth time of him going through the questionnaire and then the app crashing and not submitting it, finally he's like, yeah, do you want to just write this down and then we'll just find a way to fax it to them or something? Mm. And I was like, it was amazing. Because, like, on instance number 2, you think, like, at an American bank, they'd be like, yeah, clearly we're having a problem. It's Friday. Like, let's just do this. But, like, the guy was like, nah, it's the computer. It's a computer, and just kept fucking doing it. And like, so I watched some of like the best of, you know, Computer Says No clips on YouTube as well, because I didn't want to just base my commentary on this on solely on episode. I wanted to see some of the other things people talked about. That's why I watched the Ting Tong ones as well, which I feel dirty saying out loud. And yeah, like that is fair, especially in this country. There is this sort of like, I feel as though there's this tendency towards like, well, the computer says no and I fucking don't want to do my job. So nope, can't help you. Like you and I are constantly talking about the sort of general phenomenon of British business, for example, is this thing of sort of like, am I going to do you a special best friend favor by doing my job? Or am I just going to tell you to go fuck yourself? Like, you never know. And that's why it's British business. So you're right. That is a keen observation.
Because you'll remember recently when Rishi Sunak came out and said that, like, they couldn't put out these, like, benefit increases to people to combat the cost of living crisis, like, in a timely fashion because the computer system would not allow them to do so. It's like, it's the computer says no. You're the Chancellor of the Exchequer and you're standing at a press conference saying the computer says no. Like,
yes.
Yeah, that is... I remember when I went to open a student bank account, this would have been in like summer 2011, sat in HSBC in Harlow, and like this guy in the, and like, I mean, they were my mom and dad, and my mom in particular was always like a difficult customer at the bank because she used to work in a bank. So she was always like, this is like, what the fuck are you doing all the time? And I remember this guy was like kind of an idiot. He's going through, like, setting up a student bank account is like the most boilerplate process ever because there's no minimum requirements for having one because you're 18 years old. Like, there's no, like, you don't have a credit history. You don't have any, like, they just give you one because you're a student. You just get one, right? So he's going through it and he's like, oh, it's not letting me do it because of your credit rating. And then, and even me at 18, I'm like, that's ridiculous. I don't have a credit rating. I'm 18. I've never had any credit. And he's like, no, the computer's saying that your credit rating's not good enough to have a... And then at a certain point, yeah, because... And then my confidence in this guy had already been knocked. And then because he'd asked me, like, where I was going to university. And I was like, Cambridge. And then he's like, okay, what county is that in? And I'm like...
Cambridgeshire?
Would you like to take a wild fucking running jump at a guess? And then he's like... And then he has to, like, click on, like, a county on the map. And he's like... Can you point it out to me? And I'm like, motherfucker, it's 40 miles from here. Like, how do you... Like, what... Like, it's like you could be there in under an hour. Like, how do you not know? Whether I'm like, okay, whatever, fine. And then he's going to say, and we're going like, no, but I can't have a credit. Like, I literally do not have a credit rating. And also, you don't need a credit rating to open a student bank account. So why are you trying to? And then he's like, no. He's like, no, it's fine. It's nothing to worry about. Probably just someone else has taken out some credit in your name in like a fraudulent way. And I'm like, how have you managed to string together it's nothing to worry about and then say something that seems like extremely something to fucking worry about? We then get the manager over and she's like, yeah, no, the computer is saying no, he is right. Then it unravels that he was trying to open me some fucking like advanced adult bank account with a huge fucking overdraft. So obviously it was coming back. You can't give this 18-year-old kid this, and it's like, and he was just not opening a student bank account. And it's like, that is like living in this country in a nutshell. It's just like,
yes,
constantly dealing with people. Like, how do you remember to breathe? Like,
no, I mean, my wife has asthma, and on one hand, we're constantly like grateful that we can live in a place where we don't have to fear getting kicked off our insurance or, you know, paying for healthcare. But on the other hand, it's just sort of like, at this point, you know, there are two medications that you need to order. Like, and it involves the computer. How do you fuck this up every single time? Every single time. And it's just like, yeah, it is part and parcel of living here. So it's like, there's an observation that's good, you know?
Yeah, there's an
observation that's telling, that like people can identify with, but that doesn't necessarily require you to be in bondage gear or in drag or in a wheelchair or in blackface. You know,
Little Britain, very much a show by a gay guy and a guy who pretends to be gay for some reason. Like, I don't, which is the weirdest possible energy. For Americans who are not familiar with David Williams, like Matt Lucas, since this show has been on, has been pretty quiet since it went off the air. I mean, now he's one of the hosts on Bake Off, but that's kind of a recent thing. Like, for a long time, you kind of, like, I would say for about 10 years, you didn't really see
He was
much.
Definitely a Corbyn does anti-Semitism guy. And then people would be like, remember when you did lots of blackface? And he actually had apologized, unlike David Baddiel. But it did come up that there was a little bit of soul searching on his part about, perhaps I might not have done that.
Yeah. But then David Williams is like, he is a weird fucking... Without wishing to be actionable about David Williams, there are a lot of rumors that circulate about David Williams and what he may or may not have been up to over the years.
I can cut it. What are they?
But yeah, so I would say David Williams emits a fucked vibe. That's what I'll say about David Williams. And like, he basically has gone on, unlike Matt Lucas, to have like quite a glittering career in British television. Like, he's for a really long time been a host on Britain's Got Talent. And he has been like a real, like a big star. I mean, like in a shit way, but like a big star. And his whole deal is that he's a straight guy who acts extremely camp. And I don't know how to like describe, like, I mean, be camp if you want, sure. But it's just weird. It's just that there's an oddness about it that I can't, it's uncanny valley. Like, I can't explain. It seems very put on in a very like, where if a guy who was gay was acting like that, you'd be like, fine. But sure. Something weird about this straight guy kind of putting on this very...
If you're a straight guy and that's just how you are, then like, there's nothing weird about that. But if you're doing it like you're... If like, this is how you talk normally, but then like as soon as you're like on camera, you're like, oh, darling. Like, that's weird. That's kind of
weird. He feels like he's in a Monty Python sketch all the time.
Yeah, he's playing the 70s gay dude in a Monty Python sketch.
Yeah. And it's just very, very strange. I think that's my bit on David Walliams to introduce Americans to David Walliams. But yeah, he's an odd guy.
And you're saying he hasn't done any introspection or soul searching about how fucked this show is?
I can't say that for certain, but I know that Matt Lucas has done it more noticeably, for sure.
Lucas also looks like fucking Brother Berenger from goddamn The Name of the Rose. So like, he's just a very odd looking guy, and there's an extent to which like he's
a bit like Mr. Blobby made flesh. He's got that kind of an energy.
He's also in the video for the Fat Les song Vindaloo, and I was just like, wow, there's like three dudes that I know who've done blackface on British TV in this music video. Like, it's just unreal.
The indicative of what British TV was like in a certain era. Yeah,
it does kind of feel like sometimes, although stuff has gotten in some ways more crass, in some ways more kind of, I don't want to say like vapid, but like the extent to which like the reality TV stuff becoming really, really dominant, normally there is a kind of like cycle of nostalgia about certain eras and like, oh wow, music was real back then, that kind of shit, you know, that. And that happens, I think, with regardless.
Yeah.
I've never seen people be nostalgic about TV that was on in the early 2000s in Britain.
That definitely
with the exception
is.
Yep. Of people talking about Dick and Dom in the Bungalow, because like that was a kids show that people liked.
that's like a thing with people a bit younger than me, I think. But there's definitely stuff like Peep Show is a big one. That's one that people like really, really fondly remember. There was definitely like, but I think a lot of the good stuff in the 2000s, it was either like indie stuff, which a Peep Show was. It was like a low budget show, at least to start with, and like it was.
Am I thinking of Brass Eye or Peep Show? Yeah. The one about the one thing we didn't want to happen.
That's Brass Eye.
Okay,
Brass Eye is earlier. That's like mid-90s, maybe even early 90s.
Because Brass Eye is incredible in terms of like how fucking far they push the envelope. Like that genuinely...
Yeah, there was some incredible stuff on British TV in the 90s. Like really, avant-garde stuff. And I think like Brass Eye, The Day to Day, fucking... those were both Chris Morris vehicles. But I mean, like the people who were working on those shows, like fucking Steve Coogan, Armando Iannucci, like all like really smart people in British comedy. The Armando Iannucci show was great. That was like a sketch show that was like... really fucking weird in the, like, I don't know, you've probably seen the sketch about like the house that's made of paper and like the East End thug threatening a washing machine and like all this kind of like the Armando Iannucci show, like, or, like people who aren't familiar with it, like, on, just go on YouTube and just stick in Armando Iannucci show. This is really good.
I know
stuff.
It's later, but like I was weirdly an American fan of that Mitchell and Webb look, just because one of my best friends was really into it, and so he would always make me watch it.
Okay,
and
so like, that's kind of contemporaneous with Little Britain, right?
Yeah,
it's like a similar. And so yeah, there was some good stuff on TV. I think what really sticks out at me about British TV from the 2000s is how fucking mental it was. Like, it was really the peak era for a certain kind of, like, everyone's had a head injury, but, like, the budget is massive. Like, the peak era of Big Brother, like, the fucking, like, the Jade Goody season of Big Brother, like, fucking Davina McCall, people like this, like, just shows which were, like, utterly insane. Fucking,
I remember my mom was a fan. She was like, what British comedy is popular? And I was like, well, this is one thing that my friends always talk about. And I made her try to watch The Mighty Boosh, and she's like, this is the worst shit I've ever seen in my life.
That's it. Now that's a show that people fucking loved at the time and now pretend that they didn't. That was like all the fucking emo chicks at your school were obsessed with that show. And then you look back on it now and you're like, what were we smoking?
It's sort of like Invader Zim, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but Invader Zim was a cartoon show. There was the best way to describe Invader Zim is that it's extremely sort of like goth adjacent for edgy teens. Mm-hmm. The artist who created it is a guy named Jonan Vasquez, who was known in sort of indie comics in America for a comic called Johnny the Homicidal Maniac. And it hasn't aged well. Like, it seemed cool and edgy in the late 90s, but it hasn't aged well. And Invader Zim is just basically like the like Hot Topic plush toy version of that. Okay. But that's another thing where like, it was a thing that people thought of as being like cool and interesting, and I'm using edgy with scare quotes, and now I think like overwhelmingly if you look back on it, it's just cringe, like extremely cringe.
Yeah, and I think that there's a similar thing with the Mighty Boosh. Like, I don't think it's really offensive, or not in any meaningful way. I mean, there might be the odd thing in there, I don't know. I mean, it ran for a long time.
Sure.
Stands to reason there's probably something, but it was just very surrealist. It was very like random source is the only way I can describe it.
Yeah, monkey cheese random kind of shit.
Yeah, exactly. It was like that peak era of like just random, surreal, random. But whereas like the Armando Iannucci show was like surreal, but in like a really like in a way that felt satirical rather than just random. But and again, that's one of the weird things about Little Britain. I think some of the really surreal sketches that it had, which none of which featured in this episode, but you sort of recall and you're like, yeah, there's something funny. There's like flashes of a better show in there, but it's just never explored. Like they had a running sketch where they had Dennis Waterman, who's like a well-known Brit. Now, this appeals to me because I love British like C-list celebrities. Mm-hmm. I love that as a type of guy.
Friends, if you haven't listened to our Bristol Transform show from this year, Milo goes to town on a list of C-list celebrities who are going to be involved in the Queen's Platinum Jubilee Parade.
I had so much
exhibition.
Fun with that because
he knew all the names and none of the rest of us did.
Yeah, it was particularly funny. And then I was like spitballing other people they could have invited just to confuse Riley. I'm just throwing out people Riley has never heard of and will never understand who they are. Trini and Susanna. Another show that was on in the mid 2000s, fucking How to Look 10 Years Younger or whatever with Trini and Susanna. Yeah, incredible stuff. Wait, what was I talking about? What were we?
You were talking about
surreal sketches, right?
Yeah.
The sketch about Dennis Waterman, who is this British actor. He's probably in his 70s now, but he was on a bit of stuff. He was definitely in like a lot of popular British TV shows like in the 70s. Like he was in The Sweeney, I think, maybe, or like some of these like cop dramas that were popular in the 70s. Like a British version of something like Chips, you know, like that kind of era, like cop show type thing.
I only know about the Sweeney because he's referenced in a Squeeze song, and I am a fucking insufferable tiaboo for a certain genre of British cultural product.
Yeah, don't write in if it's not the Sweeney. It was something. It might have been the Sweeney. It might have been like the Flying Squad or like one of the like 70s British cop shows he was in.
Yeah.
And then in the mid 2000s, he was in this British cop show, which was like kind of a comedy cop show, but it was like But that would be an interesting one to look back on, actually, because I think it had a certain charm to it. I remember my parents really liked it. It was like it was about retired cops who had been brought back into the police to do like cold case investigation, and them just being like crotchety old guys who like didn't really get along with each other. Kind of that sort of being the vibe. And he sang the theme. He wrote and sang the theme tune for the song, which apparently Dennis Waterman over the years was well known for doing this. And so they had this recurring sketch where it's just Dennis Waterman in a meeting with his agent, except that the agent sat on one side of the desk, and Dennis Waterman is tiny. He sat and he's like absorbed by the chair. Like the chair is massive, and he's like Action Man size. He's like sat in the chair, and then he's going like, "Yeah, Dennis, I've got you an audition for this new thing." And he's like, "You want me to write the theme tune, sing the theme tune?" And then like none of this is like it doesn't sound like Dennis Waterman. It doesn't look like Dennis Waterman. Like Dennis Waterman's not a particularly small guy. Like the whole thing was just, but it was so surreal that it was kind of funny. It was just bizarre. And then it like this had become such a thing for Dennis Waterman because it, like this was what people knew him for at this point.
Oh, wow.
Because he was like, you know, like boomers knew who he was, but like younger people didn't. And he had to like come out in public and be like, "I don't understand why I don't get it. I don't understand what they're satirizing." And so, yeah, there were like weird things like that, which were almost like weird cultural moments. But yeah, by and large, you look back on it and you're like, it's so shoddily done. There's so few jokes in it. It's just like, leaving aside the politics, it's a badly made television program.
Yeah. And I think the thing for me is I just came away from it like, there's a scene where a guy, like, his mates come over to help him with his grandma, and the guy just immediately, like, goes, like, full sexual mode on the grandma and is, like, sucking her toes and stuff like that, and it's just...
That actually did make me laugh. I was like, this is so bad, but it's like, guy wants to fuck your grandma. At least that's... It had sort of a cumtown bit energy to it.
That was just, yeah, like, I watched this and I just didn't I just didn't find it funny. And I guess that's fine. I'm from a different country. I'm, you know, I wouldn't have been the target.
Yeah, I don't think that's why it is.
No, but let me, what I'm saying is that like, those are all the sort of like caveats, but the truth is I came away from it more surprised than anything else that had been, that it had been such a big cultural phenomenon at the time. Because I can think of a show back in America that I think was on a whole funnier, more consistently funny than this. Well, two shows really that don't really have a ton of kind of like cultural cachet or a thing that people reference or care about. One is Mad TV and the other, which is sort of, I think Fox trying to do a competitor for Saturday Night Live. And the other was the show that was called House of Buggin' in some markets and the John Leguizamo show in other markets. But it was John Leguizamo's sketch comedy show, which was primarily, it was sort of like a rude 90s sketch comedy show. But like the fact that he's Puerto Rican and that he made lots of jokes about Hispanic culture were like big part and parcel of that. So like there were like this running bits about like Chicano militants who were really fucking stupid. There was this one sketch that I remember, I was just like, wow, I can't believe they got away with this. It was basically about like this, like this fake heartfelt documentary about a guy who basically like is doing like a Big Brother thing for like a kid without a dad. It's just so he can fuck the kid's mom. Like it's actually like very, very funny.
George Costanza out.
And it's like it was actually a funny show, but like there's a very small subset of the population that's my age or older that would even really remember House of Buggin' because like it just didn't really, like we thought it was fucking hilarious. My family, for some reason, my parents thought it was funny. My parents were so uptight. They fucking watched Pulp Fiction and then they were so offended by it. They were like, they had like a crisis of conscience about it. And they're like, we're only going to watch certified good movies from now on. So they were like watching all like
And then Nathan, he said he had the watch in his ass.
They were watching like fucking like Defending Your Life, like early to mid 80s Bill Murray movies and stuff like that, like just stuff that because they were so
palate cleanser.
They were so offended by the fact that Pulp Fiction was considered a good movie and they just didn't connect with it at all. Which I mean, in fairness, imagine my mom and dad who met as army officers who were both like Reagan conservatives, you know, watching a movie and all of a sudden
I enjoyed like, Jackie Brown. That was a good movie. Pulp Fiction took it too
that
long.
One came out later actually. So but imagine my parents in 1995 just expecting a good movie and they just get, does he look like a bitch?
Yeah.
Like they were not really into that.
Marcellus Wallace doesn't like to get fucked by anybody except Mrs.
Wallace. Also, here's some feet.
It's a story about marriage.
It is, in fact.
And a wife guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
And some other things, too. And a guy who says the N-word a lot.
Yeah. There's a lot of guys saying the N-word in Tarantino
movies. Yeah, it's weird how that works, yeah.
Yeah.
So, in the end, Little Britain, all I can say is, you monster, you made me watch this piece of shit.
I'm catching you up on what having a childhood in Britain was like.
I was
made to watch this for many years.
Is that I think the thing for me is that my friend's story just kind of resonated more with me here watching this now that like if you were one of the demographics of people that were getting lampooned in this show, like how mean-spirited it was, how like not even like there's nothing I can compare it to because I mean aside from the homophobic shit that was going on in America at the time, but like, you know, cuz like Chappelle's Show was really funny, but Chappelle's Show would definitely do homophobic stuff, but like some of it's aged better than others. And obviously Dave Chappelle's now gone on to be like super transphobic. I don't know if you remember, if you've watched Chappelle's Show from the early.
No, I've seen some of Dave Chappelle's like old stand up from the 90s, but I've not seen any of
Chappelle's show was this thing on Comedy Central. And it was actually very, very popular. It ran for like two seasons, I think. He may have brought it back later. It was sort of like a victim of his own success. It became so runaway successful in the second season that like, it was affecting his ability to do stand-up because people were just screaming his own bits back at him when he was trying to do stand-up.
Specifically,
he did this thing where, like, because he's friends with Eddie Murphy's brother, Charlie Murphy, they did this whole sketch about Charlie Murphy hanging out with Eddie and his friends in the 80s and, like, for example, meeting Rick James and the whole, encountering Rick James, who's just this fucked up dude on drugs who's an asshole, and Charlie's just like a very much not take people's bullshit guy who's like just gotten out of the Navy and his brother is famous, having to put up with Rick James trying to fuck with him just like slapping the shit out of Rick James, Rick James coming over to his house and all fucked up on cocaine and deciding to own Eddie Murphy for having a white suede couch by rubbing his muddy boots all over it. Like all this stuff is like reenacted with Dave Chappelle playing
white suede couch.
He's just, fuck your couch, fuck your couch. It's fuck your couch. It's like a fully guy from my generation thing that immediately brings you back. But it's Dave Chappelle like reenacting all of this stuff dressed up as Rick James. So really funny. But there's a really funny sketch on Chappelle's show that's also like really, really homophobic in retrospect, which is the gay DMV. Basically, the idea is that like states that allow gay marriage basically, or they're going to ban gay marriage, and now gay people are just going to have to like make parallel institutions across America. And if you're going to have gay marriage, then you also have to have gay other things. So what about the gay DMV? And it's just like a bunch of dudes voguing, like taking their DMV photos, and like a guy's getting a custom plate that the plate is ass milk. And and then it's like, what about like
your eyeballs?
Gay, or like gay landscapers. And there's like then cuts to footage of a guy in like black motorcycle, like black leather motorcycle bondage gear, basically twerking next to a lawnmower as it runs on its own, while the music in the background is just ass and titties. Like, it's just fully fucking insane.
Not so interested in titties, I think.
Yeah, I don't think so. But it's just...
they needed a bit more research on the Chappelle show.
It's, in retrospect, like, yeah, it was really homophobic. I mean, it was funny as shit, don't get me wrong, but it was also very homophobic. So, like, I can't say that this stuff was in any way all that different, but I think the thing for me is more like, when I look at this stuff, when I think about the gay DMV, that was funny.
Gay DMV is such a cumtown bit.
I know.
It's amazing.
I know. No, 100%.
You know, like the cumtown bit as an archetype has always existed throughout history.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way, or like the black Ku Klux Klansman who's blind and doesn't know that he's black. Like, that's a whole sketch. Like, all of his sketches with white people are very, very funny. Like, where it's just him and white face. Like, they're actually very, very funny. And I think the thing about this for me is that, like, because the jokes aren't funny, it just feels like it's just more or less victimizing minorities, and there's not even a punchline. There's not even anything that could make it in any way sort of like a comedic moment. It's just sort of like pointing and laughing. It's just like grotesques. That's the thing that makes this so weird to me.
Yeah, because I think also there's like a weird thing where like a lot of the characters, like, so for example, like the guy in the wheelchair, that character that we picked up on. So like so it's not clear from that sketch that you saw, but he's not actually disabled. Like, that's one of the running jokes, is that he'll like get out of the wheelchair when the carer's not around and like go and like take stuff that he's not supposed to have or whatever, and then he'll get back in the wheelchair before the guy comes back in the room. So it's like a kind of like, yeah, like the characters are all grotesque, and it's like that. And I think that's what comes back to that kind of like oblivious thing for me, where it's like it's incidental, like weird, like you can sort of see they think that they're like doing character comedy.
Yeah,
but it doesn't work out that way.
No.
That's not what they actually produce. But yeah, it's like they're trying to just do this like grotesque character, and then what they end up falling into is all of these like kind of stereotypes. And
yeah,
like, yeah.
And it's just winds up being grim.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly,
really, really grim.
Yeah.
Well,
so yeah, strange.
That's Little Britain. Fuck you for making me watch it. But again, we have
it's
content.
My pleasure as always.
So thanks again for being a Patreon subscriber and a Britainology subscriber. For this $5 tier Britainology episode, just bear in mind that if you want a second Britainology each month, we have a $10 tier that includes that.
We do.
And we are hot at work preparing the content for that one.
Yeah, it's going to be British chip shop food.
We are going to talk about all of that food gore, footy scran, smack barn pee wet, all that. We're going to talk about chip shop food.
It's the wet off the peas.
It's the wet. It's no peas. It's just wet.
That's right.
We're going to talk about that. So look for that this month as well. And thank you again.
Cheers.